This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
What if I told you that you can support your blood pressure and healthy CoQ10 levels with two chews a day? The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. That's like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 supports your cardiovascular health. Visit RadioBeats.com and find out how you can get a free 30-day supply on bundles and save 15% with the promo code DEAL.
Hi, I'm Emily Hahn. I am a naturalist, a writer, and teacher. My work focuses on intersections of nature, culture, food, and plant medicine. So I do many things from writing books to teaching online courses and in-person workshops and nature walks, writing recipes, all kinds of things to really help people connect with the natural world around them.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Thank you. How has being part Vietnamese, what does it mean for you?
That's an interesting question. I think it's something that has that I've thought about throughout my life and probably kind of shifts, you know, in different types. So that's a question that I probably thought about for much of my life, and it's kind of, you know, shifted and meant different things at different points. I think it's growing up with Vietnamese as my primary language until I was about the age of five, you know, in some ways I think being Vietnamese is that language and something that's really like embedded deep within me, although today I can barely speak Vietnamese. So yeah, I can kind of understand, but I'm so out of practice that, you know, and yet it's still something that I think the sounds is, you know, something so deeply familiar and comfortable, you know, comforting. But that's something that, you know, that being Vietnamese means to me, I think. You know, traditions that I learned, you know, from family, from, you know, food and herbs and stories, holidays, you know, things like that, you know, has been an important part of my experience. So, you know, even being half Vietnamese, I think it's something that, or not quite half, almost half Vietnamese, you know, something that that I do, you know, think about in terms of, you know, what does it mean to be kind of, you know, integrating multiple cultures and identities, you know, as a part Vietnamese and part Vietnamese American person.
Right, right. We talked on a little bit on the pre-interview. How much Vietnamese culture, or how much do you have to have inside of you? And what does that even mean to be saying, you know, how Vietnamese you are, right? Because that's something we explore a lot. Is that something that matters to you, or is it something that, you know, is a natural kind of thing that's inside of you because of your experience?
Right. Yeah. It's a tricky thing. And, you know, I'll at different times in my life or different moments that I have, sometimes even still today, you know, I'll get caught up in thinking, you know, what percentage Vietnamese am I, or how much Vietnamese culture did I grow up with, or do I still use today? And, you know, trying to measure it that way. But, you know, I think I really realized that, you know, to me, that's not really what makes me feel Vietnamese or makes me feel connected to Vietnamese culture. It's those other things like my family, my food, thinking, you know, connect, like acknowledging my ancestors, you know, things like that, that that make, you know, being Vietnamese or make me feel like, you know, that I am Vietnamese.
You have a very interesting lineage to Vietnam. Not biological, well, of course, biologically, and of course, culturally, but through your mother. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, my father is Vietnamese Chinese and actually grew up in Cambodia. So you know, there's kind of multiple cultures and ethnicities and nationalities, you know, within his family experience that passed down to me. And then my mother is Anglo-American, but she in college, she read some work by a Buddhist teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, and became very inspired and reached out to him and wanted to help his efforts. And so she ended up moving, he was exiled in France at the time, and she ended up moving to live with him in France and learned Vietnamese and ended up translating many of his books into English. And then was basically sent by him to rescue Vietnamese boat people. And so she went on a boat in the South China Sea, and she met my dad, who was basically the first mate on the boat. So you know, even though, you know, she is being of Anglo-American, you know, I also absorbed a lot of, you know, language from her, as well as customs, traditions, recipes, you know, things that she had learned during her time living with Vietnamese people. And so, you know, that's another thing I you know, kind of try to tease out sometimes too. You know, I learned some things from my father or his mother and his siblings and that part of my family, as well as other things from my mom too.
What year did your mother go to Vietnam?
Oh gosh. You know, I don't remember exactly the year. And she didn't actually go to Vietnam. She ended up going to Thailand and Singapore, and they kind of traveled around. My dad, the ship they were using had left from Cambodia. And so they were just kind of, you know, going many places.
So this sounds like it's after the war, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Five, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because she is traveling on the peripheral of the periphery of Vietnam.
Right, right. She wasn't actually in Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
And so it sounds like she was sort of moving around, kind of transient for a few years.
No, it was much shorter. I think it was a few months, shorter period of time than that. I think it basically, you know, I think she kind of got thrown into this, not exactly knowing, you know, what she was in for, but she spoke Vietnamese and then she spoke English, which was, I think, you know, really they were looking for somebody who could help them, you know, maybe get through some of the red tape and, you know, things like that by speaking English. So so that's
now I know that this is going to be a strange question because you're not your mother, but I would love to hear what you think. How do you think that whole experience changed your mother?
Oh, I think, you know, profoundly. I'm certain. You know, I think she was already very idealistic and an activist, and had been arrested for, you know, protesting the Vietnam War in the U.S. and things like that. So I think, you know, she was just ready for anything and went. But I can't even imagine. You know, I don't think she probably even imagined what she was really in for. You know, as she was going off on this, you know, this refugee ship and you know, meeting these people and then meeting my dad. And I often think about how brave, you know, she must have been, but also probably because she probably didn't know exactly what she was in for. You know, she was young and willing, you know, willing to do that.
Does she still talk about the experience with Tai at this moment, during these last few years?
Yeah, you know, we have actually been talking about him more recently. You know, he is very, you know, elderly now and has gone back to Vietnam. And you know, I grew up, like, throughout my childhood, we would, you know, often see him. We would go to retreats and you spend time with him and things like that. And you know, it was kind of funny for me in some ways, like, he kind of felt like he was a family member. I mean, he was a revered teacher, but, like, you know, I think some stories about me, you know, when I was little, and I would, you know, I would sometimes speak to him in a very familiar, you know, way in Vietnamese, and maybe not proper, but you know, I really felt very, you know, very fortunate to have that experience growing up. And then, you know, as I got older and moved away from home, and, you know, things changed. It has been a long time, you know, since I've seen him or since my mom has seen him too. But I think we both, just recently, you know, I was able to visit my mom, and we were talking about just what a profound impact, you know, he's had on our lives, just, you know, from, you know, particular, you know, Buddhist teachings and meditation practices, but really just like, just our everyday life, you know, just the way that we approach things and see the world. And yeah, I'm really very grateful for all that.
So what was he really like? Do you have, do you have a sort of a description of like his personality?
He, you know, it was funny. I think about when I was a little kid, and sometimes I would actually be a little bit of, I would be nervous because he would always want me to sing. He would love, you know, he loved, I think, songs. And so, yeah, I would, you know, being someone who I think was more introverted and it didn't like singing in front of other people, I was always a little bit worried, is he going to make me sing? You know? But he was, I mean, such a warm and truly very like grounded and peaceful presence. And I mean, really, you know, as much as on one hand, you know, maybe he seemed like a family member or something, and you could, you know, I could feel that special presence of his. And yeah, just, you know, just the way he would, you know, drinking tea with him and things like that, you know, it's really wonderful moment.
It's interesting, like when somebody like me, who's really on the outside of all of that kind of Buddhist culture, and you know, when I read something about a new guest like you, and I get introduced, a friend of mine said, oh, you should check out Emily and who she is. And so I'm reading, and it's really just a lot about your work as a, you know, in the herbalist community and nature community. But it sometimes, or most of the times for me, I could see the lineage of, you know, how things affect you and how, you know, things sort of rub off on, you know, our childhood and these wonderful things that we meet and encounter. And I, you know, I just extrapolate and I'm like, oh, okay, well, sort of, that's sort of like where the love of nature probably comes from. Is that true, or am I way off?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely correct. And, you know, some of it has been, I think, more consciously in my mind, and some of those things I come to later is like, oh yeah, of course, that's, you know, why I have a certain perspective on, you know, interdependence of plants and animals and people and, you know, things like that. It's like, if I was steeped in that, you know, from a young age. I think one of the experiences that I can really, I feel like I trace a lot of that back to is, so with Tai, we would do tea meditations, but with the children, he would often do tangerine meditations. So we would, you know, we would have like, a, you know, each have a tangerine, and we would be peeling and experiencing and eating that tangerine in this mindful way, like people might do with tea. But it was, you know, wonderful for children, and just that, you know, just that being present in the moment and the, you know, sensory aspects of being with that tangerine and seeing, you know, he talked about seeing the whole world, you know, in your cup of tea or in that tangerine. So it's the sun and the rain and the farmer, and, you know, the bees and, you know, everything encompassed, you know, within that. And so when I look at, you know, how I approach herbs or connecting with nature, it, you know, really does all trace back to that kind of perspective.
How lucky and fortunate you have to be to have got to experience that wonderful exercise.
Yeah, I do feel very fortunate and to, you know, hopefully be able to weave it in some way, you know, into the work that I do.
Another person that came up was Cesar Chavez, that came up in my reading about you.
And you... Yeah, when I think about kind of the big influences on my young life and still kind of my perspective today, you know, would be those two people. And he's another person, you know, brought into my life by my mother. She had participated in a lot of his boycotts, for example, like grape boycotts and because of the pesticide used on the crops. I guess in the 80s. And so I grew up, you know, going to marches and things with him, and When he would come to, I grew up in San Antonio, Texas, and when he would come to town, my mom would actually like cook his, he would eat like vegan meals. So I don't think there weren't a lot of like vegan people in Texas. So, you know, people knew of my mom and they asked, you know, if she would do that. So, so he was not someone that I was spend as much time with, or, you know, felt, you know, not as close to in the same way that I felt, you know, with Thich Nhat Hanh, but just going on those protest marches or just seeing what he did. And, you know, I think really affected just my sense of social justice and environmental justice and things like that.
Now, these two people are major figures in the world, in our modern life. They've just been, you know, they've made huge impacts in the way we exist. I guess my question is, when you follow the trajectory of what they've done, are they doing massive strokes, or are they doing like little bits at a time that has incrementally moved the world? Or, I mean, if you kind of analyze the way that they have shifted our thinking, what's the velocity are they special people? Are they like that, these giants that are able to do it? Or is it just like these small little steps? I'm always curious about that.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, like you said, I mean, we kind of see the impact that, you know, standing here today, we see the impact that they've made, and it can seem, you know, really huge and broad. And I mean, it is, you know, they have made had massive impact, but, you know, and it's even sometimes something that I look at, like, okay, these are my teachers, you know, like they did this, you know, these like massive impactful things, and, you know, what am I doing here? You know, kind of. But then having seen, I guess, you know, some of like sitting there eating tangerines, you know, with a group of children, or, you know, going from city to city doing marches and, you know, meeting the people, you know, there. And I see that those big things are made up of, you know, those like individual actions, and that they were, and consistently over time, I think, you know, for them, it wasn't just, you know, one big act of protest or, you know, something like that. It was for their, you know, has been for them, you know, over a lifetime, and affecting, and I think that they did, you know, have had something special, you know, within them, but it's also because they connected to so many people, and, you know, through, you know, thousands of people, you know, across the world, you know, were able to have that impact, because it's not just them, it's like the greater communities that they've helped create and foster.
So growing up as a little girl and, you know, coming into contact with these figures, what did you want to do?
Like professionally, or?
Yeah, like growing up, did you have dreams of becoming a farmer, a scientist, a writer? I mean, what was going on through your mind as you're experiencing these people through your mother and directly through these people?
Yeah, I think I had lots of, you know, various dreams. I think I wanted to travel, I think, because, you know, through them, I saw, you know, kind of, and other people, you know, in my life when I was young, you know, world outside of, you know, just San Antonio, Texas and stuff. So, you know, I saw that. I did, you know, I would write a lot. I would create like little publications, like little magazines. I made something called the Children's Peace Magazine. So I was always really interested in like publishing stuff. So, and I think, you know, with some sort of purpose. So, you know, like a peace movement, or I became a vegetarian when I was 5 years old. So I was often, you know, interested in, you know, creating little, you know, publications to encourage people, you know, to with vegetarian recipes in them, things like that. But I had all kinds of interests. You know, I wanted to be a scientist and a musician and this and that. Yeah, I think I there were all kinds of, you know, wasn't just a one track, you know, vision of what I was going to do. And you know, since then I have done all kinds of things. I did work in publishing. I was an art librarian for a while. I worked in finance because I needed some work. And so, you know, so it's been, you know, kind of a a path that's included many different strands in it. So that brought me to where I am now.
You sound like a true creative. So when you got into university and you began to sort of study the world, I mean, how were you narrowing the path or your direction?
So at that time, I was really interested in, well, still kind of that vision of publications and books. And so I was really interested I studied art history and the history of the book and printing, throughout different eras, from like early printing presses to more modern avant-garde book arts and things like that. But I guess I was just always really interested in these combinations of like text and image and in these forms that these forms of books or publications that people could hold in their hands. And so that's that kind of was what I did for a while.
That's an interesting branch of interest. Mm-hmm. You're talking about like Heidelberg and lithograph and that kind of like printing.
Printing. Yeah. Yeah. There was a time when I thought, I was going to become a letterpress printer or something too. That was another path that, I thought about.
there's a very fascinating letterpress printing company in LA that you can go and see it. They're on the corner of, I think, 7th Street near Hoover or something like that. They're called Aardvark. Mm-hmm. Aardvark. And they have these, I think they even have like these old printing press that, they put the alphabets, what do they,
the types.
Mm-hmm. the types on, and they load it in, and then these arms pick up the ink and it just does that. It's really fast.
I love that. So that was kind of, I think, maybe my trajectory for a while. But I throughout this, for a very long time, I was really interested in food and cooking, and I loved that. And I was working as an art librarian when my husband was working for a website called Apartment Therapy. And they had a sister site called The Kitchen, which was all about food. And he basically signed me up to start writing about food. And at first I was really angry at him. I was like, I love cooking, but I don't write, about this, or I don't create recipes. But it ended up becoming a passion. And so I really, really got into writing recipes and helping other people cook in their own kitchens. And
what did your husband do at Apartment Therapy?
He was an editor. So he writes about design and technology. But he was a graphic designer and then a product designer who ended up becoming a writer, like basically writing about those things.
This is a random question.
Sort of roped me into that too.
Yeah. This is a random question, but have you ever ran into a person named Vanessa Vargas over at Apartment?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We all worked there at this around the same time. Yeah.
Friend of mine.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. I remember her. She's an interior designer. My family, we met for textiles from Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
And so LA interior designers, I was very, very close with, and Vanessa and I were friends for many years, and we still keep in touch on Facebook, but I remember her writing for Apartment Therapy. So it just,
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I haven't seen her in a long time, but yeah, we definitely did those early days at Apartment Therapy.
Oh, what a small world. Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. So, you were writing for food for this spinoff of, or the sidearm of Apartment Therapy. And, what kind of articles would you write?
So I would write farmers market reports. I would go to different markets, usually the Hollywood farmers market on the weekends, and I would take pictures and talk to the farmers, and I would kind of do like a little seasonal report of what was in season, related recipes, different cooking tips and things like that. Or around that time, I would be writing usually like a recipe a week, and so a lot of the times I would just call on trying to think of, what to do would be the recipes from my childhood. So, I would do like Vietnamese recipes, but making them vegetarian, that's how we would eat them, either growing up or what I would, you know, how I would do now. So it was a lot of like kind of adaptation of things. So I would do that. My husband's Korean American, so I was learning a lot of recipes from his mom, and so I'd be inspired by that. You know, I would be doing like Korean vegetarian versions of recipes. It was a really good experience, just because back in those early days, you know, the staff was small and we had to write a lot, you know, so it's just like, you know, I think in some ways that was great, because I didn't have time to necessarily like wait and procrastinate and think about what I was going to write. It was like, just gotta get, you know, get things out there. So that definitely,
it's good training, right?
Yeah, it was good training.
So at what point did you really get into the sort of the herbal, obviously I've been researching, but this like certified California naturalist stuff, like how did you transition, or what made you sort of like shift into that?
Yeah. So that was another thing that I think, being in the natural world, you know, spending time outdoors and with plants and animals and hiking and things was a big part of my childhood, you know, whether it was my family going out and doing something or just hanging out in the backyard, like in, you know, with our Vietnamese herbs, you know, things like that. And then when I moved to LA, my husband grew up here, and he really loved, you know, hiking and spending time in the natural world. And so that was a lot of his way of kind of introducing me to his city, was us, you know, going to the mountains or the tide pools or the desert, and, you know, spending all this time outdoors. So that was really, I think, what helped me feel rooted in LA, was that connection with the plants and natural world here, which, you know, people probably don't, that's not usually the first thing people think of when they think of LA is, you know, nature, but, you know, we are surrounded, you know, as a city by many different, natural areas. And, you know, for me, I think that was my way of maybe, you know, connecting to where I live. So as I was doing that, I would learn about the plants and, you know, finding out that plants that were edible or that had, you know, medicinal properties and things like that. And so as I was doing, kind of learning about those, they started infusing their way into my cooking and my recipes and things like that. And so, you know, it was just kind of a gradual thing where that worked its way in. And then and then I think I realized, you know, it wasn't just the flavors or the medicinal aspects or things like that. It was that sense of working with the plants as being a way of connecting to where you are and the world around you, and the mindfulness of the present moment, and, you know, things like that. So that kind of became more of the focus of, you know, what I would do in terms of recipes or just helping people, you know, spend time outside.
Damn. Sometimes when I take these risks of asking like your mom's story and Tiknik Han, and, you know, I go on these risks because I don't know how it's going to tie in to the story. I'll be honest with you. Sometimes I'm just flying just basically on my curiosity. And I'm so glad that we got to talk about that in the very beginning, because it all makes sense to me now. The mindfulness side of things and your affinity, your curiosity to go into the natural world and explore it in depth. And, you know, when I think about this and taking it to going deeper with the subject, what does that mean to be a certified California naturalist?
Oh, right. Yeah. So that was, so there is a program, many states in throughout the U.S. will have a program that's through, so like each, most states, like through the university system, will have different programs, like Master Gardener is probably one of the more common ones. I also became a Master Food Preserver many years ago. And then, so they also have this Certified Naturalist or Master Naturalist program. So And all of these programs are basically people you get training and you learn about these subjects, and then with the goal of then teaching and sharing that with other people in the community. So so with the Certified California Naturalist program, there are many different throughout the state, like different university courses or weekend workshops or, you know, sort of week-long retreats and things like this that people can do in different places to become certified. So I took a class through Pasadena Community College, and it was a biology class. It was field biology, and so we would be, you know, every week we would be going out to different, you know, different trails and mountains and, you know, around LA and learning about the ecology and the geology, animals, plants, and then creating like a capstone project, and then to then like teach other people about, you know, some aspect of that we were interested in. So, you know, speaking of books, I made a little book about Toyon, which is one of our native shrubs or trees here in the Los Angeles area. So that's what I did for that. And then as part of that, you know, you can do different volunteer work or, you know, different things to help other people.
Toyon, that sounds so familiar. I think I went on a, is it a hiking trail?
Oh, is there a trail called, I'm not sure. It's the Bright Red Berries. But actually, the story is that Hollywood is named after them because, people who came from the East Coast would see the bright red berries that are in season, you know, during like this, you know, winter time, and reminded them of Holly. And that's called it Hollywood. I don't know if that's true, but that's the story. Like
a great story, great origin. Yeah, I think there's a hiking trail that I saw, the Toyon Trail, just up in the Pasadena or Altadena area.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's what it is, a bright red berry. And so being a California naturalist is different, because it sounds like it's more like a whole environmental thing, but like an American Herbalist Guild. I know that's not what you went... I think it's your writing partner in one of the books.
Yeah. I'm not a registered herbalist with the American Herbalist Guild. My co-author and co-teacher.
Correct. But I have to ask what that is too, because that like very interesting as well.
So there's no like formal licensure or anything for herbalists in the United States, but there is this organization, this guild of herbalists that they, you know, have standards for professional practice and education and things, so people can apply to become members of the American Herbalist Guild, you know, based on you know, the studies that they've done and the, you know, clinical experience and things like that. So it's a, you know, professional organization.
And what do people do with sort of these certifications or degrees? There doesn't sound like there's an actual degree, but what do you do when you pursue the path of, here's my Asian, side of me, the practical application?
There are, you know, so many different ways, I think, to be an herbalist or to work with plant medicines. And, you know, some people, they become clinical, practitioners, and they work with clients and have health issues. And both of my parents were acupuncturists, so I grew up with, you know, with herbs in that sense, and was never at all interested in becoming an acupuncturist or going into that path. I think my father really wanted me to take on the family business, but no, I was not interested in that at all. Well, of course, eventually, you know, I did start becoming much more interested in, you know, herbs and health and things. But I think I still saw that the clinical path wasn't really, you know, really what sparked my interest. But, you know, that's something that people can do. People can become medicine makers. So they will actually, you know, formulate and blend like the teas and tinctures and salves and things like that. There are people who write articles or books or, you know, teach classes. Take people out into the field or teach them, you know, how to make medicines. There are, you know, just so many different ways, you know, and I think, which has been wonderful, I think, for me just to
be around.
just to see, you know, there are all these different communities that people can work with and perspectives, you know, that they can bring and different plants that they have relationships with and stuff. So it is, you know, it's a really rich world, I think, of herbalism. So for me, you know, it was, I found it was really like helping people connect to the plant and the natural world, like where they live, and nurturing their senses, you know, so they can really slow down and have those relationships and those moments of you know, mindfulness, and as well as teaching people how to make the medicines. You know, I started out teaching more workshops for how to like make drinks and cocktails and things like that. And I still do some of that, but that kind of morphed into like teaching people how to make the herbal remedies just in their own kitchens at home. So I just love, yeah, being able to help people have that empowerment, you know, to be able to make it themselves.
So can we go back to your mom and dad?
Yeah.
So they both studied acupuncture after they met then, right?
So my dad had started studying in Cambodia. And then, but, you know, then with the circumstances of needing employment and war and, you know, all kinds of things, he eventually, you know, ended up working on this oil tanker, you know, so he was not a practicing acupuncturist or anything, but he had started his training. And then, so then when my parents moved, so after the ship, they lived in France for a while, and then they moved to the US, and then my mom got acupuncture training, went to acupuncture school in the US, basically so she could help him, you know, set up a practice, in the US. So they, you know, they shared the practice for a while, and eventually it you know, was really my dad's passion, I think. So, my mom was, you know, stopped being an acupuncturist, but he's still an acupuncturist today. He still has two offices in Texas that he works out of.
Your mom is an incredible woman.
Like, yeah, she's pretty amazing.
Yeah, pretty amazing. And to have, you know, step in and out of so many different fields and mm-hmm. modes of being is so incredibly powerful.
Yeah, I think it has been a really good example to me through my life that, you know, there you can do many different things and at different stages of your life. And so that's, I think, in some ways, that, you know, I was probably lucky to not grow up with some of the more stereotypical Asian, you know, expectations for career and you know, things like that. But I did get some of that from my dad, but
I had a good example there. So guilty is not the word, but my wife went to Yosan here in LA for a few years. And, you know, she talks about it a lot. She talks about the herbal side and, you know, and I come from such a strange scientific, my brother's really into science, the heart science, and talks about these articles and, you know, living forever because of science. And I'm somewhere kind of in the middle where I think that it's important. Science like that, heart science is important. Western science is important. But mm-hmm. at the same time, this herbal side is not talked about enough, I think, in American society. So there's this sort of like this middle, probably this middle area where, and I want to ask you about that. How can I find out, or how can people find out about like scientific studies on herbs, and how could we come to more of a understanding of the herbal world that's not official in like an aspirin or penicillin? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, you know, I fully agree. You know, I think that there are gifts and benefits, you know, to both of the perspectives, or you know, or not just two, but you know, many, you know, different avenues, you know, to health and stuff. So, you know, we have the more Western scientific traditions that are, you know, super important, as well as a lot of these more traditional herbal tradition, you know, practices. And so, you know, I think the more that we can like respect and weave the two in together is really important. And, you know, there's kind of different ways of looking at it, because there are a lot of scientific studies being done on certain herbs, and on one hand I think that is really important. You know, it is able to prove, you know, certain things that maybe haven't been, you know, proven in that, you know, realm before. And so that's really important. But a lot of times those studies will take like a certain constituent of an herb, like a certain chemical of it, rather than like kind of the more holistic, you know, traditionally, you know, our ancestors or, you know, and our grandparents, you know, they were eating the whole herbs in their foods or in their remedies. And I think, and also probably, you know, spending time with those plants in the places where they lived and gathering them. And I think that there's also a really important aspect of that too, that would be missing if you just take a pill that has, you know, whatever isolated constituents.
You know, yeah. You don't put an herb in a centrifuge and you know, just take and pick what.
Yeah. So, you know, but I think there is room for both. My co-author from the Wild Remedies book and hopefully co-teacher for a course that we teach called Rooted Medicine Circle, Rosalie de la Forêt, she is great at like researching a lot of those scientific studies. So our book together, and then she has another book called Alchemy of Herbs, and she is really, you know, great at diving into those studies and you know, that did like human clinical trials and things like that and looking at that. So so her, you know, her work and her articles, I think, are a great resource for that. And then, you know, being able to as much as we can, you know, talk to our elders and, you know, the people who do still have those traditions is really important. A couple years ago, I went, most of my Vietnamese family lives in Boston and I hadn't seen them for many years, and I went and visited, and because I work in herbs now, they were like so interested in talking to me about the herbs and, you know, sharing things that they had grown up with or, you know, remedies that they knew about and stuff. And I mean, I had like an uncle by marriage, and I mean, we probably like only spoken like maybe 5 sentences to each other, you know, like in my life, but like suddenly it was like, you know, we were talking about plants and herbs, and then he was talking about his childhood, and like, you know, it was this avenue into, you know, into connecting. And so I think that's been that was wonderful for me, and I think it, you know, can be you know, hopefully for, you know, people who have those family members who might have experiences, can be a wonderful way to talk to them, you know. And like, I wasn't asking him about his childhood or about the war, or, you know, my father doesn't talk to about a lot of that, or my other relatives, but you know, we started talking about herbs, and then suddenly, you know, some other things, you know, get shared. So
now, is there much of a difference in the size of the Eastern herb studies or understanding versus the Western herbal realms?
Yeah, you know, I think there's probably been, you know, a longer tradition and more probably respect, you know, paid to the herbal medicine, you know, on the Eastern side, that there is, you know, a plethora of stuff on that side. I think that there's a lot of, you know, there are a lot of like traditionally Eastern medicine herbs that we can, you know, definitely, you know, incorporate into, you know, our lives, you know, like maybe living in the West, but in a lot of cases, you know, I think it is also really important to learn about the plants where you live, and, you know, so that they're not necessarily being like shipped across the world and you know, grown on these mass, you know, scales, you know, everywhere, that as much as we can, I think, try to cultivate plants ourselves or work with, you know, local growers and local herbalists. I think that there's a lot of value in that. So, but at the same time, you know, there are plants that are really special, you know, from Asia, or that we have like cultural connections to. So that's something I'm always kind of like playing with too, is, you know, I have a really love for the California native plants, and so I grow a lot of those and work with them, but I also grow a lot of like Vietnamese herbs, and you know, I have like, they hate the dry weather and like where I am, but I have a little greenhouse to try to keep them happy and we're nice and humid, and so they may not be like a native plant, but I have a very deep connection to them, so they're also really important to me. So I think, you know, people can weave in, you know, other plants that are, might be important to them and in different ways.
Our backyard in the Amazon and all of these places are quickly depleting because of deforestation. Whether we, mm-hmm. whatever side of the argument anybody's on, like that stuff is disappearing, period, right? There's no argument. Yeah. Is it something that can be stopped? The loss of all of these natural, powerful resources in places that we are killing?
Yeah, no, I think it is a really important question. And, something that I hope that we can stop, but then sometimes, I think we may be too far, too far gone, and we need to be resilient and adapt to, whatever our new world is going to be. But at the same time, working, together to do whatever we can to try to, stop those things from happening. I think, I hope that, in some of the things, like if somebody can start to spend more time connecting with the natural world, like just outside their own door, that hopefully that can then spark something bigger, that then they can, through that love and connection, with the natural world, just where they are, they can then want to protect it on a larger scale too. And and then that's something I wrestle with, thinking about, we talk about like these figures, who do really big things and launch, huge movements. And I absolutely think that we do need that, for sure. And that's really important. But then, sometimes thinking about like where my skills lie, or something, sometimes it's maybe less than, or it's not so much like going to, to the Amazon to, stop something from happening. And I'm really glad there are people, who are more, I guess, maybe activist, types in that way. But I'm hoping that, what I can do is just help people maybe change some things in their daily lives so that then they can have that perspective to want to work, for the greater world community
too. Yeah, be more aware of just our local surroundings, right?
Yeah. Because if we don't even care about, the stuff down the tree down the street, how are we really going to care about, plants and animals in places that, they're so far away? So,
yeah. What are your thoughts on plant remedies and natural remedies in relation to the coronavirus and COVID?
Yeah, that's a, that can be a fraught question, but, I think COVID is so, we're a couple years into it yet, but it's, still very new and changing all the time. And so there isn't, herbalists don't have a lot of experience in, treating COVID specifically. I don't think that it's responsible to be, saying these are the remedy, herbal remedies we can use to prevent or cure or, COVID. I think that can be really irresponsible. But there is a long history of using herbs to help, support our immune systems and to work with certain symptoms and things like that. So I think that, hopefully, if we can be integrating those herbs, into our lives to hopefully just be healthier, overall. And, if we do get COVID and, have some like respiratory symptoms or something, that, that there are herbs that, that we could use to help ease that. So I think there, there's definitely place for it. But I also, I think it's really important for people to know that there's not going to be, I don't believe, that there's an herbal cure for that.
It's good to know.
Definitely, we need to be listening to the science and our doctors and as well.
Good to know we're not going to be banned on YouTube for Have you been back to Vietnam?
I have never been to Vietnam. It's my whole life. I mean, it's been like my lifelong dream to go. And I think I waited for a really long time to go with my father. And so I was always waiting for a time when he was ready and interested to go. And then finally, a couple years ago, I decided, I'm just going to go by myself. Or actually, then I had an aunt who was interested in going. So I was like, all right, I'm just going to do this. And then COVID hit. So I'm still waiting, but, you know, hopefully in the near future.
What do you think it'll be
like? I'll be able to do that. I don't know. You know, I think it's like, I guess I hope that in some ways that some things will, there'll be things that maybe will feel familiar or will make sense in some ways, but I think there'll probably be a lot of things that are, you know, probably feel very foreign and different to me. And I'm sure that that will also have me questioning, what does it mean to be Vietnamese again, you know, and kind of, you know, thinking about that. So, yeah, so I expect it'll be a pretty interesting, you know, at the very least, you know, experience. But yeah, you know, good thing about not going yet is it gives me a little more time to work on my Vietnamese. So I feel a little bit more prepared.
There are so many Vietnamese Americans with both parents that are Vietnamese that can't speak Vietnamese, that go there, connect, and, you know, have a sense of some sort of belonging to Vietnam. Mm. And so I think that whatever your whenever and wherever you go to in Vietnam, it's going to be definitely a life-changing experience. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about it when you come back one day. And that would be an interesting tidbit, because it's like it'll complete the cycle of full circle with your parents, and there's so much herbs and so much of that sort of like naturally happening in Vietnam from old.
Yeah, I'm so eager to learn about that.
Yeah,
there. So
I really appreciate your time today. You know, we started off as a pre-interview, but it turned out to be this wonderful episode for me, and I've learned a lot, as I usually do with people that I know you know nothing about. I know nothing about your field, and you know, today was just I'm sure it's just a teaser for all of the information on herbs and that sort of world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate getting to talk to you.
Emily, I appreciate it, and thank you again.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts. Thanks again for listening.